Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis. I don't think our listeners know this, but every time you say the managing editor, I do like this little shoulder dance.
Yes.
It's good. A good vibe.
I like it. And reporter Jacob McQuinney.
Wow, don't sound so disappointed.
Where's your shoulder dance?
With that intro.
Yeah, how am I supposed to do a delighted shoulder dance when it sounds like I just swatted your milkshake out of your hand?
Coming up on the show this week, the rain keeps coming. The region is getting drenched once again, and some neighborhoods remain in crisis. Some homes have been ruined, and people are displaced. We used to do a hero of the week, and this one would have been easy. A local spear fisherman saved his street from worse damage and devastation last week when he dove down and cleared a drain. We did that story. City leaders say they were bound by regulations against clearing some critical channels, and we've spent a lot of time, as others have, examining that claim. Our environmental reporter got a different take about the regulations standing in the way or not. We'll explain. The council president said now is the time for a tax, and that means now is the time for me to explain some things. Sorry. Taxes, fees, and how they all get passed. I got you. Finally, a lot of homeless folks are in crisis and go to hospitals for help, but a new story by Lisa Halverstadt shows just how ill-equipped hospitals are to help them after they're done being treated. It's going to be a good show. Stay with us. Okay, we have a couple of things to talk about before we get into the content of the show. First off, next week is Voice of San Diego's 19th anniversary of its launch, which is crazy. But today, February 1st, 2024, marks 10 years since the death of our founder, co-founder, Neil Morgan. I just realized that today, and that guy, you think I'm poetic? You think I'm good with words?
Do I?
Yeah, I think you think that. He would send notes after, like, we did something good, you know, after he'd left the organization, kind of, spent a lot less time with us. He would still send us notes after we wrote something that he liked or whatever. And it was just gorgeous. It'd be like two lines of like how it made him feel, how important it was to the community. And it was always just like so special to get one of those. Miss that guy. He had a good vision. He had a good run as a newsman, old school newsman in San Diego. RIP to Neil Morgan. And we will be recognizing our anniversary and everything else with our show, right?
Live podcast. We'll be at Modern Times Beer and Coffee in Point Loma on February 8th. 8th.
So there's a little disagreement about whether we launched on the 9th or the 8th. But I think it's, I always go with the 9th. So
I would say 9th because I hate even numbers.
Why?
I don't know.
Okay.
Just go with 9.
Where does that disagreement come from? Do people just,
bad memories.
Forget?
Oh, I think that the stories might have gotten, the website might have gone live the night before, but the 9th is when everybody like read it and stuff. So the organization formed in 2004,
okay,
but the launch was right after the new year in February. So
I see.
We'll have food, beer. We had a show at Modern Times a long time ago, and it was led by former co-host of the show, Andy Keats. And now he's coming back to talk about big projects in the city. We'll probably have to talk about this stormwater stuff. He had done a lot of research on that stuff while he was here. We'll get his take on some of that. We want it to be a great show, big show. So tell a friend, get your tickets at vosd.org/events. Again, that's vosd.org/events. We'll see you there. Okay, we have an update on the show that we talked about last week, some issues we went through. We told everybody that the Metropolitan Transit System was going to have a big report released last week about why it fired Grecia Figueroa, its former, public information specialist, and what it did, whether it had any relationship with, that firing had any relationship with Nathan Fletcher, the former chairman of the organization, and of course, former county supervisor, and the scandal that led to his downfall. And so this report was going to come out. Remember, the report wouldn't exist without our reporting after the scandal broke, saying, like, are you guys going to look into this and reveal why she was fired and what you knew when you knew it? And they did commission that independent report, and that report did come out. And you and I, Andrea, did do a list of takeaways from that report. We read it so you didn't have to. And there was a lot of interesting stuff in there. What stood out for you?
So I think we talked about last week, and we've been reporting these sorts of questions that we've had as an organization, putting it into context in the morning report for readers. But basically, we had two big questions, like what happened between them, which we talked about last week's episode, and why was she fired? You know, when did they know the things that that came out in this lawsuit?
Yeah.
And so the report, I think overall, they've interviewed the head of HR, her direct managers, the CEO.
Not her.
And not him. He provided written responses to their questions.
And some of them were like, no.
Yeah.
Why do you think they didn't?
Well, that's what happens
her?
When you, it said in the report that her like attorneys wanted like certain, I don't know, like certain things, like they wanted to be in the room, they wanted to record, they wanted access to some of the interviews. And so the people conducting the investigation said that that was not like a common or best practice in these types of investigations. Okay. And it just seemed like they just didn't, you know, they couldn't figure it out. And so they didn't interview her. But they interviewed all these people, and what the report lays out is that Nathan Fletcher had like no role in why she was fired. They all talk about like performance issues and how, you know, they felt like she was not very organized and she had all these things and blah, blah, blah. But there was one really interesting moment for me in that report and finding was that when Grecia was brought in to Jeff, who is the HR person for MTS, when she was brought into his office, he told her like they were considering firing her. What was the correct?
They were interested, in terminating her employment.
Such a strange
and
way to put that.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm interested in asking you out on a date.
Yeah.
Or I'm interested in breaking up.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
And then, negotiating a separation agreement with you, which is not anything I've ever seen. Like you get if you're going to fire somebody, you're lined up, or you should be lined up with everything. And, and you know, if you're going to give them a separation agreement, you give it to them. If they want to come back something else, then you do that.
Yeah. And usually like what people like take their stuff from their desks and all this stuff. Like there's a process. You don't like talk about, I'm interested in firing you.
Right. So what he drives home is that He did not actually fire her on that day when she has been telling everybody that she was fired.
Which, like, she aligns and connects to Nathan Fletcher because that's the day he announced that he was going to run for state senate. So she says, Nathan Fletcher announces that he's running for state senate. I get fired the same day. Coincidence?
Yeah.
That's like her argument, right?
Right.
But basically, like, MTS, Jeff from HR is like, no, I didn't fire her on that day. I just talked to her about, like, we're interested in firing her that day.
Yeah.
So, okay, that happens. She goes on to send a coworker a text message letting them know, I just got laid off. This is huge. This is big. She doesn't mention Nathan Fletcher by name, but she, like, hints that this is big. This involves this involves a board member of MTS, and
hint, hint. It's somebody who just made an announcement.
Yes, mm-hmm. Like cough, cough.
Yeah.
And you know, the person that she's texting is clearly uncomfortable in these interactions. Does not want, like, he's like, I don't want to get involved in drama. Like, please don't tell me, whatever. But this person goes on to tell Grecia's boss, like, she just texted me this, like, here you go. And so her boss, Mark Olson, then figures out, puts, you know, two and two together, who made a big announcement, who's our board member, Nathan Fletcher. And so then he takes this, these messages to MTS's CEO and general counsel.
Yeah.
And you see that in the report, and okay, that happens. And so at that moment, it's like, huh, shouldn't that have been a huge red flag? Like, wait a minute, we're interested in firing this person.
They haven't actually fired her yet, as they wanted to make clear.
Uh-huh.
They hear that she's now connected what they're doing to her to the chairman of their board. And yeah, alarm bells don't go off.
Don't go off, or you don't want to deal with it. I don't know what happened, but nothing happens.
But they're talking about the two top people in the organization, Sharon Cooney and the general counsel of mm-hmm. the organization, see these and they're like, wow, this is something.
Okay. Yeah.
They haven't actually fired her yet. And then they don't do anything with it.
No. And then she gets an official termination letter.
Like 10 days later.
10 days later.
So in that 10 days, they haven't actually fired her. And rather than investigate what she's saying about this what she thinks is the reason for this, they don't do anything to look into that at all. They don't even ask him if he knows something about her.
Yeah, like, I don't know. For me, I'm a manager now, right? And if something like that happened, I would say, whoa,
put the brakes.
Let me just, what is that about? Why is this person who is, like, yes, someone who would interact with our board chair, but not necessarily, right? She's not the CEO who's, like, constantly with the board chair. Mm-hmm. So I'd say, like, why is this person in this position saying that her firing is related or somehow related to our board chair? Like, that's weird. Let me find, I don't know. I would be extremely curious to know, like, well, why this person is saying that.
Well, it seems like from, you know, all of the officials at MTS and even this person that Grecia is contacting, they are just a deeply incurious organization. I mean, I cannot imagine somebody, like, texting me what Grecia texted and being like, no, don't tell me. I don't want drama.
I'd be like, send everything. Yeah. I want all.
You'd immediately get, like, three back-to-back calls from me.
Give me the cheese, mate. No, but this person didn't want to get involved, and that's their thing.
I don't understand is what I'm saying.
We don't, because we're cheese muscles.
Yeah.
Cheese muscles, so we don't understand. But it blew my mind when I was reading it. I, like, read it over. I called you and we were talking about it, and I was like, and then not only that, like, they're never like, wait, pause, what's going on here? Like, the investigation says that eventually, like, Grecia's lawyer sends MTS and Nathan Fletcher a letter letting them know, like, you know, like, I'm representing her, something's coming, like, please hold all your documents. And then CEO Sharon
Cooney, yeah,
yes.
This is a baffling thing to me. I do not even what was she thinking? She texts Fletcher after you know, Figueroa's lawyer send letters to MTS and to Fletcher. She texts Fletcher, quote, FYI, we have a terminated employee. Grecia contacting you. Our council is aware. Sorry to involve you.
Sorry. So alarm bells don't go off. They don't stop this termination and look into what she's saying. They go, and the one step they take to check with him is to send sorry
My
to
bad.
Involve you yeah. in this. It's just, yeah, it's your point, deeply incurious, is really good. Like, they don't have any interest in why she would be telling people that she has, that this is connected to him at this moment, and or any interest in figuring that out. They're just like, she must be, you know, just making stuff up.
Problem
sorry to involve
employee,
you.
Yeah.
Or they just understand what that means and, like that employee, you don't want to hear more.
Well, and then the investigation goes on to say that then there's a phone call between Sharon and Nathan where, you know, they talk about this. And he says, like, it's not uncommon for me to be named in lawsuits, you know, because I'm board chair or whatever. He gives no, like, hey, something you should know here. But that doesn't happen.
After a board meeting, I had this thing with yeah. this lady next door
yeah.
to where you are now.
That would yeah. be a deeply humiliating conversation.
I don't know. But that moment, I mean, there's lots of parts in the report that are really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, like you pointed out, she was fired and, well, she was hired. And then the way they do it, they do like a performance review after like 6 months, right?
So the first 6 months and mm-hmm. then a year, yeah.
Yeah. And then as with any like sort of review, right, they give you positive comments and like they rate you with something. And you always have stuff you want to work on, right? Like you want to improve as an employer. Here are a couple of things. Here's some feedback, things you can improve on. But every year they gave her like good reviews.
They said the first time was just below exceeds job requirements.
Mm-hmm.
The first 6 months, it was barely below exceeds job requirements. At the 1 year mark, it was exceeds job requirements. And then at the next year mark, it was exceeds job requirements. That's when her relationship with Nathan Fletcher starts. And then the one last one they give her was meets job requirements, but they include a line that says, if you don't make immediate improvement in these things we've identified, mm-hmm. your job is in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. So there are multiple very strange things there. I mean, one, if you are meeting job requirements, how is your job in jeopardy?
Yeah, that's great.
If you don't improve. I mean, that's very strange to me.
Yeah. Like,
and it's also very strange the fact that it clearly shows that after beginning her, you know, whatever you want to call it with Fletcher, that is when her job performance starts to decline.
Yeah.
And also, not only that, but she was given like a new title, which you can assume is like new job responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things that stand out here. Before they decide to actually terminate her employment, now she is an at-will employee, can be let go at any time, but in order to protect yourself as an employer from other sort of, you know, lawsuits and stuff that might come after letting an employee go, there's usually a ramp up of progressive reporting about what they need to do before it's mm-hmm, time mm-hmm. to actually pull that that step out. And so they make a decision at one point where Jeff Stumbo, the head of HR, says to this manager, Mark Olson, who has never fired anyone before, that one option we have now is to do an actual performance improvement plan where we're going to outline exactly what you have to improve over exactly what period of time in order to save your job. And that's usually the last step you make before a firing for performance reasons. And Olson says, no, she's just going to improve a little bit for a while and then it's going to get worse again. And they decide not to do that. And then when they meet with him with her to talk to her about this interest they have in terminating her employment, Olson doesn't go. It's just Stumbo, which I think, look, if you're going to fire somebody, you need to look at them in the eye and make that decision about why and tell them, you know, what you're doing at that moment. That's the only honorable thing for a manager to do at that moment. And I think, like, so he doesn't. He's never fired anybody. He gives it to this guy who's just like, I'm interested in firing you. And then they find out that night and nobody does anything. They don't stop it. They go forward with the firing. It's just, it's a wild sequence of events.
I think, like, put the relationship or, you know, assault on the side, right? I think, you know, we've talked about that. It's, you know, from her original lawsuit and what we saw compared to the entire dump of Instagram messages, I think, like, it's much more complicated. The lawsuit painted a picture that, like, you know, it's a different picture when you actually look at the messages between them. There's definitely flirtation between both of them. You know, Nathan was not upfront with MTS's CEO about, like, hey, you know, just so you know, I had a relationship with this woman. Okay, let's put that all aside. You have an agency, public agency, who hired this, like, young Latino woman, only Spanish speaker, apparently, that they had at that time.
In that group, at least.
In that group. She's performing. She needs things to improve on. They gave her a new title, which I'm assuming comes with a few more responsibilities, and then end up deciding that, like, no, let's just get rid of her. And, you know, throughout the report, there's, like, other sections where the investigators interviewed her coworkers.
You're forgetting one thing they discovered in the path.
What?
That she was underpaid.
Oh, yes. She was underpaid.
They give her a raise. When they say that she's just meeting job requirements, they give her a raise of 3%.
Because she was underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
Her coworkers say, like, they all kind of struggled with her, right? Like, she seems like she was a very free-flowing employee. Like, she knew what she wanted to do, but, like, maybe she wasn't the best planner or something. And that put people in positions where, like, you know, they had to scramble to get something done for her or whatever. We've all worked with a person like that. But it's just like...
You looked at me.
No, not you. No. Not you, Scott.
It's fine.
But yeah, we've all worked with somebody like that. But I mean, this is an agency, like, they're one Spanish speaker. They were underpaying her, like...
They gave her a new job responsibility.
And then they're like, you know what? Let's get rid of her. Like, it's too much. It's too much work, like, to help her. I just can't understand that. And then to, like, find out that she somehow thinks that her firing has to do with your board member and that doesn't, like, scream at you is insane.
You know, you stack all of that up and put it next to the fact that this is the first person that Olson has ever fired. I mean, I'm sorry. That's just... That doesn't pass the smell test for me, personally.
Well, the report includes all of these takes from board members and the mayor, Todd Gloria, and they're all like, we think this agency's done fantastic. And it's just like, okay, thanks, guys. You can see all of that at vosd.org/Scott. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
I don't think the community of Southcrest has ever had this many reporters and journalists around as it has over the last couple of weeks, as people really digest what happened to Southcrest, Shelltown, these areas of southeastern San Diego that were brutally flooded by the January 22nd, was it, deluge. It was just an intense amount of rain in a short period, and areas that are always getting flooded with heavy storms got flooded way more than they had been, and now everybody's pointing fingers. And honestly, I'm not sure that local leaders have really met the moment, you know, with like the command sort of, we got this, we got you, we're here. And so there's a lot of really bad feelings stirring around, especially with this community that was devastated. Mackenzie Elmer went and found, as there are in all of these sort of situations, a hero. And it was a really great story that helped illustrate the problem, too. Which was, there was a spear fisherman who noticed that he grew up in the area. He noticed that one of the drains wasn't working. He went to try to get it cleaned out. The firefighter's like, get out of here. Go. That's our job or something, right?
No, more like, probably like, dude, don't be in the water. Yeah. We don't want to have to, like, rescue you.
Yeah, exactly. So he goes back, he gets his wetsuit on, and he goes and finds another drain, digs it out, and is able to stop the flooding, and a whirlpool starts to really drain it out. Great story. But also, why was the drain clogged? Could there not have been some resources to make sure it wasn't? Is it? What are we learning about the drains, and what are we still hoping to find out? Because there is an area, as Mackenzie noticed, a canal sort of stormwater drainage system that looked like a wetland, as it I guess is considered in some ways, of vegetation and lots of stuff going on. They've just cleared it, so obviously they can clear it now, but the question is, why didn't they clear it before? Mm-hmm. What are we learning about that?
Well, we're learning that the city of San Diego felt that there was all this red tape that they just couldn't pass, right? That there were state agencies that disallowed the clearing of these sorts of drains without of these sorts of canals, creeks, without a lot of official documentation and blah blah blah. But according to Mackenzie Elmer's piece, state officials have said that the city of San Diego has had permission to clean creeks like Choyas for a long time.
Well, here's what they said. This was Chris McFadden, the Department of Stormwater leader at the city of San Diego. I believe talking at Lincoln High School after the extent of the damage and catastrophe was sort of being absorbed by the community, and the mayor was addressing with all kinds of public safety people what had happened. And there was sort of an outrage from just the public and the media that were there about what happened. And here's what he said.
So two things have to line up in order for us to maintain a flood control channel. We have to have the funding for it, and we have to secure environmental permits from the resource agencies, Fish and Wildlife agencies, Army Corps of Engineers, etc. That is a years-long process, and at this point, the city has an inventory of about 200 different channel segments across the city, and we're currently funded to do about major maintenance on about four of those channels per year. And so we prioritize those channels and maintain the ones that we can, but a lot of things have to align.
So in order for that to happen, that really stands out. There's 200 or hundreds of these channels, and they can only do that type of heavy maintenance work on four of them and not that one. Now, again, Mackenzie Elmer asked one of the regulators that they're referring to there, and he said, well, the city does have clearance to do routine channel maintenance work in preparation for storms like these, and has had that since 2021. The city can dredge a channel, cut down trees, or tear out exotic or invasive vegetation without additional permits under this authorization. Quote from, this is David Gibson again from the Water Quality Control Board. He said, we have made it easy for the city to be as flexible as possible. So there was an effort, sort of the city say, like, it's not our fault. They make us get all these permits. And then this guy's like, nah, you could have done it. And then they went and did it. And they said that they only did it because they had this emergency declaration. But I think there is some truth to all this, right? Like, they do have some regulatory hurdles. They don't have the money to do it. But these questions are going to continue to dog the mayor, especially as the extent of the damage is really revealed. Now, you talked to some folks in Southcrest and been following them. It was bad. It was devastating.
Yeah. I also spoke with some residents in Stockton who told me that they didn't see as much flooding as they did in the Southcrest area, but they were like watching with anticipation, like just watching the water flow up. And they were like, do we leave? Do we stay? Like, what happened here? I know some houses on that block were damaged, but just I can't imagine the anxiety. I mean, one of the residents I spoke to, we were talking and she was like, do you know where I can get sandbags? Like, we don't know what to do. Like, we've done our best to like clear any sort of drains that we see. But you could just tell like she had extreme anxiety about the rains that we were getting today.
I mean, it was, I visited Cesar Chavez Elementary School, which is on Beta Street, and spoke to the principal, walked around, you know, Beta Street, which was kind of the ground zero of this flooding. And it's hard to overstate just how surreal of a scene it was, right? You walk around and you see just a mud line on all of the cars, all of the houses. Every car is sitting open, trunks open, as they're just hoping these things will dry. All the cars are sitting kind of askew, where you can just see that the water carried them away a bit. I mean, when I showed up at Cesar Chavez Elementary, I park the car and I start walking to the school, and I look over and see a tow truck that is attempting to tow a just beat up red SUV out of the creek bed. And I walk over and there are three cars in that creek bed right here, all kind of like pushed up against each other. And further on down the creek, you could see two more cars. I mean, there were five cars in this small stretch of creek. And you know, there are people carrying, you know, items out of the houses, stripping the walls, taking wood out. And speaking to that principal, you know, he was at school that day with students, and they're just standing there watching the water rise everywhere around them. Luckily for them, they really only experienced flooding in kind of the field area and the playground, but they were preparing for the worst. I mean, he said that he was asking his janitors, like, hey, do we have pumps? I mean, what can we do? And so it really is shocking, the degree of damage. And regardless of whether or not there was red tape that the city was unable to cross, I don't think that's going to be enough for many of the residents who've lost absolutely everything.
Yeah, to hear people say that. I mean, looking at the images, even some of the images that we included in Mackenzie's story about this cleaning of the creek that could have happened before. I mean, it's just like people's homes, entire lives, just out on the street like garbage. I mean, it's so sad. Like, this was stuff that was in their home safe. You know, like it wasn't going to be on the street if this hadn't happened.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. There were just little traces of people's lives all over.
There's a uncomfortable history we should acknowledge as well about this. San Diego, of course, is a very segregated city. Some parts of the region and the city of San Diego are very white, and some are lots of population of people of color. And the reason for that is that there were areas of town, neighborhoods of town, where people of color could not live and could not own homes, could not get financing for homes. And there were areas of town where they were allowed to live, and particularly southeastern San Diego and Barrio Logan. And these two areas, Southcrest, Shell Town of southeastern San Diego, were part of those areas they could live. And just so happens, obviously, horrible historic coincidence, that those are the areas that are most likely to flood, right? I'm sorry, that was not the area to add sarcasm in. Like, obviously, those are areas that some people with more privilege were able to avoid and say, like, okay, you can have your homes there because that's not some place they want to go. And so there is an uncomfortable sort of dual experience here. A lot of white neighborhoods did not experience anywhere close to this devastation. And a lot of people of color are suffering this, like, and this very devastating version. Like, if it were a fire, most likely their homeowners insurance and renters insurance would take care of it, no problem. But floods are only covered with flood insurance, and flood insurance is a whole different reality for a lot of people, and availability, and it's only available in some cases if you have a mortgage out there, or you would even think to get it if you only had a mortgage that required it. So a lot of things to work through. I think we're trying to get our arms around just how many people were displaced because of what happened, how many structures and homes were completely 100% damaged based on what happened, how much is salvageable. But there's the ongoing things like mold. Like, you fill a house full of water, you're going to have a mold problem forever. And those kinds of things are something that are going to take a long time to deal with. So we'll get our arms around that. Now, the city council, at least parts of it, are furious. Sean Elo Rivera has, I think, really taken a stance that is going to take City Hall a few months to deal with. He said and announced that he is going to now pursue a tax on November's ballot that would finally address this stormwater deficit. So do you mind if I get into this a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
If you must.
You know, after you explained this to me, I was like driving home, I was trying to explain it to myself.
It wasn't going well, is what you're saying?
No, like, because, you know, the best way to know that you learned something is to, you know, be able to say it yourself. And so I think I had some points, but then I lost some points.
All right. Well, our former editor, Andrew Keats, did a good piece about the massive infrastructure deficit before he left that we have in San Diego. Now, an infrastructure deficit is not the same as a budget deficit. A budget deficit is where you're like spending more than you're bringing in. And so you better have reserves or you're going to go bankrupt, right? So that's a budget deficit. You're spending more than you're bringing in, and it leads to an imbalance. Now, an infrastructure deficit is the buildup of needs that have occurred because you haven't been paying for either maintenance or replacement of infrastructure. So firehouses have a lot of leaky roofs, or streets have they lose their, you know, they get more and more potholes to the point where you can't just do a easy slurry seal on top. You have to do a full like repaving, right? These infrastructure deficits are things that are wrong with our built environment that get worse and worse over time if you don't replace or repair them in a timely manner. And so we have this giant infrastructure deficit. But as Andy observed a couple years ago, that infrastructure deficit could better be described as a stormwater deficit, because two things have happened. One, we've let that stormwater system, all these canals, all these pumps, all of these drains, all of these culverts, all these different things that are used to make sure stormwater lands and is funneled out to the ocean as efficiently as possible, are maintained and built the way that they need to be built. And the state came across with new mandates about how clean that water needs to be when it runs out into the ocean. And so when the city added up everything it would take to build and replace and repair all of these different systems, it found that that would be about $1.6 billion worth of projects that we don't have the money for. What's more, it would be about $250 million per year that we're short in not doing. I'm sure I can hear conservatives right now saying like, oh, come on, this is all union, you know, stuff. Like it's not that much. But even a lot of them agree that there's something there. It's just this, like, maybe we're arguing about the extent or some of the environmental sort of mandates that go along with that about making sure it's clean. So part of what we've learned over time in these cities is that we built these cities with all these like concrete canals that sort of send water quickly out into the ocean. But that means it's as dirty as possible as it's going out there, right? So the ideal is to have as many wetlands and other sort of grassy areas that naturally filter as it goes out. And so they're really working on that sort of two-part strategy, making sure it's as clean and efficient where it's supposed to be draining, and making sure there's as much of that vegetation and other things that can clean it as it goes out. And so there were a couple years ago a proposal, and a little working group and the city council was really ramping up to put a stormwater initiative on the ballot. This used to be a big deal for the mayor. The mayor, Todd Gloria, when he was city council president, said in 2016 he would put forward this ballot measure. And so the idea has always been like, let's put forward something that will charge a tax based on how much property you own and use that to like build all these stormwater system things. So they didn't do it. And there's kind of a curious reason why. You want me to get into that too?
Yep. Well, let's hear it.
So thanks for your validation.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
So
I know it means a lot to you.
A few years ago, the state passed a law that was supposed to make it easier for these areas to raise a stormwater fee. You do pay a fee on your water bill related to stormwater. However, that is only as it connects to your drinking water. So that's a fee that is imposed to sort of pay for things that are needed to protect drinking water from stormwater pollution. So it's still like potable, right? It's not to do all of these things related to stormwater. So people say like, we have this small fee already for stormwater. It hasn't been raised for a long time. That's separate from what is being proposed here.
Do you know how much the fee is?
It's like a dollar or something. It's a very minimal amount. And so the idea is to raise a bunch of money for this. Now, the city sort of backed off doing this this initiative before because they wanted to see if the county went forward with its own stormwater fee increase without a vote of the people on this fee that the state said might be okay. Didn't happen. Hasn't happened yet. So now it's sort of been percolating. Should it happen again or whatever? Well, now we have this flood and everybody, and now Shawnee Lil Rivera is like, we're got to do it. Now he has about five questions to answer at this point. If you want to pass a tax, as we've explained hundreds of times, in this state, for specific purposes, you have to get a two-thirds vote of the people. The tax would have to be probably some version of a parcel tax that would be based on your property. So the difference between a property tax and a parcel tax is usually just a flat fee based on a parcel that you own, right? A property tax is usually a factor of how much your property is worth and based on when it was assessed, right? So, you know, if you bought a house recently and it was $1 million, then that's what the assessor will say it's worth. And you pay like basically 1% of that, which is what, $10,000 a year, right? So that's a property tax. A parcel tax would be you just pay one fee based on that parcel that you own. So this even gets more complex because they came up with ideas that said, well, let's look at each parcel and see how much of it is just concrete or like impermeable, you know, something that just doesn't allow for the stormwater to be absorbed and cleaned as it moves its way through the landscape. And so they thought, well, we could survey and we could give everybody just a sort of flat fee based on how much of their land is impermeable like that. Now, there would be some property owners that would say like, well, I already did all this stormwater stuff. I already did all these different ditches and filters and other things. So maybe I should get an exemption. So there's just a lot of questions. Are you going to do a parcel tax? Are you going to do a property tax? Are you going to give them exemptions if they've already done work? What about exemptions for low income? All kinds of stuff like that, that he has to answer now that he said, we're going to do this. And so his promise is, I'm going to put this forward. I'm going to do this. And now the question is like, well, in what way? The other thing that's interesting is the mayor and Raul Campillo, the city councilman, have been working for the last few months along with the Municipal Employees Association, the largest employee group at the city of San Diego, to come up with a full cent sales tax increase. And they've been trying to push that through. So are they going to do that and this? And maybe. Like that would be a really interesting ballot, right? And so I think it's important for people to understand a couple of the dynamics there. This is a big proposal for him to make without any details yet on some of those questions. Well, so I think it'll be really interesting to see how his council member colleagues respond to this. Will this be something they want to jump on and support? Or will they be worried that it conflicts with the other tax? Will the mayor be on board with this? Again, the city's stormwater funding need alone outpaces the unfunded need of its roads, streets, sidewalks, parks, and buildings combined. That's how big this amount of money is, or sort of infrastructure deficit this is, compared to all the other things that we know it needs, from libraries falling apart to fire stations, roofs, and all kinds of stuff. So it's a big thing to tackle. I think you can almost hear, again, like the conservatives like, oh, so your answer to this flood is a tax? Like, shocking. but you know, this is a built-up need that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have identified for a long time.
Wait, so question. So he's pursuing a tax.
Yeah.
But why not a fee?
Oh.
Your O was not surprised.
So a fee has to be, cities can impose fees if they want to, if it's to pay for the thing that you pay the fee for. So if you're camping, you pay a fee to camp at the spot, you get the camping, all the things that go along with making a campsite work, right? So if you pay a toll on a bridge, it's paying for the bridge to be maintained or whatever, or pay off the debt of the bridge, then that is. So you have to, if you have a fee that you can impose as a city or a county or a state, that doesn't need a vote of the people, it has to be related to like what the actual person paying the fee is doing or using. A tax is for things that the person might not use. So it's, you're paying something for the general benefit of the collective, you know, world, and you may or may not use what it pays for. And so there is an argument that the stormwater thing is a fee, but again, it's a legally dubious one that the San Diego City Attorney decided like, no, it's not going to hold up in court. It should be considered a tax. Mm. And so the best way to understand it is actually with this garbage situation. Remember, we 2 years ago decided, that the voters decided to allow the city to begin charging a fee for garbage collection. the only reason they had to have a vote about that is because the city itself had a law that the voters passed a long time ago that said that you have to, you can never charge a fee for garbage collection. And so we had to have a vote to get rid of that. But now the state law allows the city to impose a fee on garbage collection because you're paying a fee for them to take your garbage, and they can impose that fee at whatever level they want, and it doesn't have to be voted on by the public as a tax increase. But because this would be something that would benefit the whole, and it wouldn't be clear that it would benefit just the people paying the fee, this would be a stormwater tax, and thus it would have to go to the voters. Now, there is a way that they could just charge this tax on people's property and just call it a general tax, and then they could pass another measure that said we should bond and we should borrow a bunch of money to pay for stormwater things that just happens to equal this tax that we're going to charge, and they could try to do it at just 50% of the vote. But I think that that'll be all the that's another question that they have to answer about what route they're pursuing. You've done a good job, Andrea, of getting some freelancers.
Doing everything.
Yeah. There we go. I love this. Of getting freelancers involved. And one of them is the former UT weather reporter, Robert Cryer, who has been doing a lot of work for us. And he did a piece, and this is a crazy stat. You want to read that?
Yeah. This is from Robert's story. It says, if this week's stormy pattern does continue as expected, combined with the record-breaking downpours of January 22nd, San Diego could record 75% of its annual average rainfall, which is 9.79 inches, in less than 3 weeks.
It's a lot of water.
Wow. A lot of water. We've been texting back and forth. Robert is so knowledgeable. I mean, he covered this for the UT. So, yeah, he's been tweeting about it. Might have another post for us.
Good. Well, this is a plug to read a story on our site. Our Lisa Halberstadt did a piece about why so many providers and so many people, frankly, see people on the streets who look like they just left the hospital, because they did just leave the hospital. And it is a really tough read in a sense of just how many people are suffering that she found had real problems that the hospitals either didn't help them with or couldn't figure out before they let them out. And then they had to go back and back and back. The stats are just overwhelming about just how many homeless individuals are going to hospitals, and then how the hospitals just have no apparent sort of single hotline or anything they can call to make sure that some of the people who are leaving the hospital have some place to go. I mean, I think I've had surgeries before. You guys have had accidents or different things before. You've been in hospitals. When you leave, you usually have somebody with you to make sure that you settle in. And so the idea of leaving and then just going right to the street is itself unsettling. But that's the reality of thousands of people now. And you want to, like, this is one of those stories you want to look for, like, villains in, but the hospitals aren't an easy villain. Like, they have to serve people that come in and out as well. Yeah, treat emergencies and such. So it was a tough story, but an important one. And you can see her story and the pictures that Peggy Petey took at vosd.org/Lisa. Thanks for listening to the Voice San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in San Diego that is having a live show February 8th. Again, get your tickets at vosd.org/events, vosd.org/events. You know how fun these are. Come on out. I'm excited to see you. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez Villafana is our managing editor. Jacob McQuinney is our education reporter. Nate John's our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.